You are listening to Art Not Science, presented by the Physics Room Contemporary Art Space, a monthly podcast of artist talks, panel discussions, and other events.
Kia ora, my name is Jamie Hanton, and I'm the director of the Physics Room, a contemporary art space dedicated to developing and promoting contemporary art and critical discourse in Aotearoa, New Zealand. Based in central Christchurch since 1996, we assist artists with resources and opportunities to achieve a higher level of professional and creative development and encourage a greater acknowledgement, understanding, and value of contemporary art among New Zealanders. Our goal is to actively seek links between the arts and other areas of cultural production and to involve art as a contributing voice in wider intellectual, social, and political debate. Welcome to Episode 8 of Art Not Science. For this episode, we are reaching into our archive to bring you one of our favourite artist talks from last year with Megan Brady and Oliver Perkins. Megan and Oliver discussed the exhibition Dead Reckoning, which ran from January to February in 2019. Both artists created spatial interventions in the Physics Room's temporary home within the Christchurch Art Gallery, Te Puna o Waiwhetu. In the terminology of navigation, Dead Reckoning is a process of orienting oneself using the visual signs of the immediate surroundings without a compass or other wayfinding device. How does this occur in the Physics Room's former site, a gallery within a gallery? The artists consider the space as both a destination and as a thoroughfare for a potentially more obvious destination, especially in the tourist-heavy summer months. Oliver painted a mural directly onto the glass hallway windows between the Worcester Boulevard entrance and the Christchurch Art Gallery's design store. Titled Painting for the Clarification of Internal Architecture and Institutional Identity, the mural transformed a once transparent surface into a colourful, opaque wall. Megan created a winding path through the gallery using Dunlop memory foam, with an accompanying soundtrack and painted architectural features, in an attempt to slow navigation, induce contemplation, and celebrate the details of our built environment. Megan Brady is an artist based in Otipoti, working across multidisciplinary fields. She is currently participating in two exhibitions, Silent Agreements with Ed Ritchie at RM Gallery in Auckland, and We Painted the Walls with Cracks with Keaton Hamilton and Yukari Kaihori at PlayStation Space in Wellington. Oliver Perkins is an Ōtautahi-based artist who received his MA from Chelsea School of Art, London, and is well represented between London and New Zealand. Perkins has developed a register of material processes that both promote and disrupt the physical confines of painting. Super pleased to be joined by Megan Brady and Oliver Perkins today to talk about their show, Dead Reckoning. So a little bit of context first. I've been kind of thinking about this space that we've moved into as a temporary home for the Physics Room and how it functions over the last year. So we moved here in January of 2018 it is a temporary home. We take a year-by-year lease on the space. So this is our second year. And it's been really interesting to see with a lot of spaces how people move through the space, how they engage with the work in it. So this show was kind of, at the beginning of the year, intended to kind of intentionally focus on those things, on the spatial qualities and of the kind of psychological tics that go with the space and with people coming into the space. So I'm just going to ask each of you to, because it feels like a very relational thing, like the way that both of you have come to the project and have developed the work from that point. So I just kind of want to talk about if you could describe your relationship to the Physics Room and how you came to develop painting.
Well, I helped move the space. This is the first part, so I work here a little bit. Casual installer. And so moving from Chewham to here, it was the first architectural kind of anomaly that stood out for me, that we've got a passageway into a restaurant, into a bookshop. And then as we kind of, I guess, moved more things through and started, I think the first show was Judy's fundraiser, wasn't it?
Yeah.
And then you noticed that the passageway was just kind of an observational, because I had took on this like aquarium thing where people just walk past and leave. And also people engaging with the shows would walk in, not so much Judy's show, but probably subsequent shows. Yeah. Would walk in and see the transparent bookshop and kind of tourists mainly, but it created this flow of in through the street, through the bookshop, and quite quickly sometimes. So the whole idea of painting it was an action of disclosing the space and making people slow down a little bit and like read the show differently.
What's the title of your work, Ollie?
It is Painting for the Clarification of Internal Architecture and Institutional Identity. Tongue slightly in the cheek, but nevertheless, I wanted to make a painting that looks at painting as an action, so not a painting for, but painting as you would painting a wall or a procedural action. And also the title is exactly what I wanted the work to do, which is runs at odds with my studio practice. So it was kind of a chance to do something different from the openness of a studio practice, a painting practice.
How about you, Megan?
Well, my first engagement with the space at its new location was Jamie invited me to come down to check out the space to be a part of the show. And it was a day when you actually weren't here, and so I kind of just lingered outside and spent a bit of time in here with Hamish and used the space as a thoroughfare to get to the art gallery shop and back forward, and really observed the majority of people coming in, it being an accidental thing, you know, because of the fishbowly aesthetic of the space. People, you see them out on the street, it's a real just slip up, I think, on their behalf, and they want to get to the shop, they want to buy some trendy pencils, and this is a glass door that is open, and it seems to make a lot of sense, I think, and then they kind of get into the space, which is, it feels like a massive oxymoron, because it's a contemporary experimental art space that just happens to sit under the same roof as the commercial art gallery, and the space is very free from commercial restraint, and that space is very much not. So it felt like a really nice kind of ironic thing that was calling to be addressed, I think. When I was here, Hamish was showing me their booklet. So to maintain Creative New Zealand funding, you've got to keep like a very diligent record of who's coming into the space. And you showed me the tallies, which are people who walk into the space, and then below is a tally of people who are interested in the space. And that number is, you know, it seems significantly smaller, not to mean that it isn't valued. And the title of my work, which is The Pathway, that kind of disrupts that very direct passageway from door to door, is called The Prime Number Few. And I got that title from this collection of reasonably unknown sentences called garden path sentences, which is like essentially like linguistic fans. It's like a joke that they are on the upper hand of. It's a way of constructing a piece of writing that intentionally misleads the reader into assuming that they know how the sentence is going to go, and then through it being grammatically correct, they kind of throw a curveball. So saying them is less effective, but something like the prime number few or the old man, the boat, you know, your mind does this predictive text thing and starts to automatically think that prime number is the kind of grouping of that sentence. But really what that statement means is the prime, so people who are in their prime, the people who are the greatest, people who are, you know, the most valued, they are few in numbers. And so taking that title, I liked it because it was intentionally misleading, as this path intentionally, you know, it attempts to mislead and distract and divert the attention of the people who end up in this space accidentally. But I wanted to really acknowledge the people who this space is actually really important to, and they may be fewer in numbers, you know, to the tourists that pass through the space, but it felt, yeah, like, you know, the space does mean a lot to a lot of people. And, yeah, when you're doing something that's a little bit tongue-in-cheek, it's also quite nice to, you know, you guys are the people that title's for. So.
It's got a history to, I mean, my history with Physics Room is back in where it always was, a floor down, but early 2000s. So it's only ever been there for me, but it's just generational, isn't it? It's like we and I've come back to it recently. So the move, I guess, well, you know this more than anyone's curator, it's like your responsibility for the institution, yeah. And it going inside a bigger institution has a range of social affectations, which are, I mean, it's simplistic to say it's problematic, but there's, I mean, a lot of bigger spaces in Europe, say, would have an annex of a contemporary space that will do experimental art, but it's part of the larger, whereas this is quite a different thing. So it has a kind of parasitic relationship to the host. because, you know, I think we have to assume that we're using this temporarily and we're good neighbours and it's all with love, but it's temporary and it's like, it's an interesting social dynamic, I find. Like,
well, those parasitic relationships are often necessary. Right, to sustain the host.
No, I
don't mean it in a negative.
I know. Yeah.
But that's why it was important that the work, painting yourself in, has a certain attitude, but also the highly reflective nature of the work, I wanted that to be expressed as well, that there's something on the other side as well, and maybe you can't see in, but you see yourself walking back out of the space. It's not so much a non-space, but it's participatory in some way.
I think the non-space is a really interesting point to jump off from in terms of your thinking as well. Mm-hmm. We had a discussion yesterday, and you talked about the time you've spent in airports and thinking about desire lines and desire paths. Mm. And I guess, could you just maybe talk about the different elements of your work that kind of contribute, or the thinking that contributed to the different elements in this show?
Yeah, sure. So my practice is developing, and one kind of key detail that I'm really interested in is public spaces, but more specifically the transitory nature of them and how they're designed for people to move through. So not necessarily a destinational point. And what that looks like, you know, what the decisions that have gone on to make them comfortable to move through and to linger in but not spend too long in. And then there's the other side of it. So all of this design's gone on to make them however they are, but then, you know, watching people navigate those spaces is almost more interesting. And that was something that I wanted to totally intervene with for this work. You know, I had this work on last year, and I had made this carpet that people had to walk on to get through the space. And I had anticipated that people would make a beeline from entrance one to, you know, exit two and get through the space as fast as possible, because we're indoctrinated into knowing not to touch the art, particularly if it's in a public art gallery, you know, and to confront people with the opportunity to touch an artwork or to stand on an artwork, I think is quite interesting. So I wanted to create something that very intentionally interjected with that straight line. And
you also have the sound, the other two elements, space, the sound, yeah. and the painting.
That's right. So another kind of observation that I had made with these public spaces is not necessarily what they've been filled with. They're kind of like furnishings and how vast those furnishings are, but what those spaces also sound like. So I became really interested in elevator music and background music, because I kind of drew this connection, particularly with floor surfaces. These carpets that you see in public spaces like airports or the seat covers on buses, they are designed to be seen but not actively looked at. They kind of fill this void in the same way that elevator music or background music, it just softens a space, and it's not really designed to be actively listened to, like, you know, the party tunes in Universo. It's just designed to be there. I say yesterday to you, you know, there are details within spaces that you aren't necessarily aware of their presence, but you definitely notice their absence. And so when I came to this space and I, you know, you're engaging with the sounds of the trams moving past, and there's a lot of foot traffic, a lot of pedestrian action happening outside. There's the music from Universo, which is horrendously loud. There's the music from the bookshop, which is not, I think, don't think it's that appropriate.
Different genre, isn't it?
Yeah, and it's all of these different noises, and you're competing with that, particularly as a contemplative space. So I wanted to kind of do my best to make a sound work that kind of contained the space a bit, and it's something that's intended to be, you know, engaged with, and then dipping in and out of that, and yeah.
You are listening to Art Not Science, presented by the Physics Room Contemporary Art Space.
You're interested in active and actively looking in active spaces. I mean, I think that's what's really interesting about entering from Worcester Boulevard. And if you look at it, if you look at the wall from a 45 degree, you get this like super slick gloss finish.
Yeah, and it doesn't register any action or that, which is something that was, it was partly a leap of faith because I've never painted glass like that before, but I did some testers. But I wanted the, if you stood front on to the piece, you can see the roller marks, and there's evidence of a type of gesture there, rather than it just being like a coloured splashback. Or because, like, you know, over the road there's a piece of blue glass. There's, when I started making that, it's a really common interior architectural feature that I keep noticing now. So people don't register it. They're completely, you know, they might look at themselves and walk past, or but if you stand, it could possibly look like it's not been done very well, or it hasn't been. But Nathan actually came, when I was finishing it, the edges when I was cutting in were really transparent, and it just looks like totally unfinished. And yeah, Nathan was like, clean the edges up and make the thing. It kind of emanates the gestures differently. It's not so unfinished. But the thing when you were talking, they're both strategies that are employed by Christchurch Art Gallery as well. Like, you think about the lift music,
yeah,
murals throughout the space. So they're kind of takes on
the tools they're using.
The tools they're using down hallways, and you know, it's definitely a mural. Like, I definitely see my work as a mural.
Yeah. It's like but we had the conversation that it's probably the most un-physics room mural that you could imagine, right? I mean, it's like, it's colourful.
Yeah, yeah.
It's painted.
Oh, that's something to talk, maybe the colours is...
yeah.
The yellow and the blue are colours taken from the old physics room space when clearing the paint out. So they just got colour matched. So they were other people's projects from 2011 and 2013. One's a Pantone colour, but yeah, and the other two colours are colours that I've used, so it's a kind of merger of those two colours.
And it's colours, I mean, we're also surrounded by some of Megan's painted interventions as well. There are nine of them? Dotted around the space using
Influential, a colour called Influential, which is one of the newest released colours from Rezane's newly anticipated Colour Trends Forecast magazine of 2019, and that's something that I'm really, really interested in extracting details from. It's like, I really like writing poetry with random word generator, and I like to collect these colours for projects out of these magazines, and it's like a free service that I'm very happy to take advantage of. But it's hilarious. There's these colours that are pushed out into the trend sphere, and they've been very carefully thought about and written about, and regardless of what it is that I'm thinking about in terms of a project, there is a colour that has some sort of relevance to that project, and for this one it was Influential, which made a lot of sense. It's a great title for a colour, and it's this dirty mustard, which I'm just so attracted to anyway. These are my mustard pants, my brand new mustard linen pants. So it's a colour that I'm already quite biased towards anyway, but it being this, having this tie to being an influential colour was quite a seductive way to hopefully distract people even further if they... the zigzag pathway is kind of borrowed from, you may have seen them in Chinese gardens or experienced them in Chinese gardens, that often these zigzag bridges, which which go out across water, and the way that they're designed is to really slow a viewer or an observer down, slow their contemplation down, and to be really aware of their body in that space. So the way that the pathway, where it directs your body, is what you should be observing. And then as soon as you take your few steps and then you consciously shift your body's perspective, that's what your observations should be. So I think that's just a really beautiful way of engaging with space. And I wanted to, so correlating to each angle of the pathway, there is a focal point of influential somewhere. To hopefully assist in slowing down and engaging in the space's architectural details that are really mundane and incredibly unnoticed. But
could you give us a description in the Trend book?
In the Trend book.
For influential, how is it described?
Well, the biggest kind of draw to this specific colour was, Ollie, your work at the time, Jamie gave me a brief description of it, and he used the word porous. Mm-hmm. He said it had porous qualities, and porous is a word that I just never come across. I very rarely hear it. I very rarely use it. So I was like, God, porous, like, that's a great word. And Henry, my partner, was away travelling, and I said, tell me what you know about porous. And he goes, that's so weird because it's a word I never say and it's a word I never use, but I've heard it four times today. So it's a sign. I've got to follow the porous. So I went straight to the Resine book that had just come out, and I was just looking through the first couple of pages, and then in the first introduction, there is the word porous, and it was talking about these warmer colours being generally on the rise and carrying the promise of global exploration. So exploration was a good word that came out of that. And then it talked about porous borders, and porous borders is a beautiful two words together, but it is very loaded. Having the porous detail in that kind of structure meant it was something that I wanted to follow. And the global exploration thing, it very simply kind of explained to me the moving from one space to another, or the kind of seamless filtering of one space to another. And so, then all of the other colours had really kind of ordinary names that were true to the colour, like, Blue Lagoon or but this one, Influential, was the only one that was kind of aspirational.
Yeah.
And it was the perfect colour. And it quite nicely sits with your colours, particularly those, the yellow and blue.
It's really close to a yellow that I used a few years ago called Hacienda. And there was a weird resine found poetry game with that piece that was like, that red is called fire.
Mm.
So it's like Hacienda fire, like this kind of like club, like the club in Manchester, Hacienda fire. And I was like, next one is, what am I writing here? Mm. But it's, that's, the porosity thing is interesting because my referencing architecture is a way of bringing structural equivalences into the studio, and dealing with that and looking at kind of social context of where those are. But so when I was living in Spain, it was like the colours were so basic.
Mm.
Like there was no, because of the heat there, everything's cut with white. So you get two blues or maybe three, but then everything is cut with white to keep it from cracking. Mm. So you don't have, and then when I came back, it was like resines like this. It's like they're just in the poetry, the language and everything. It's like kind of too much.
It's a full-time job for people to keep that up.
And that was the first trip. Yeah, when I was on the Macan, I went to Resine. I was just kind of like, wow, this is too, I have to like streamline everything back. But
it's too tempting not to use, I think.
Mm.
So tell us about the origin of those colours particularly, because they refer to an older work of yours from the Macan.
Yeah, well, the first one, the fire colour, was kind of the oxide red, the New Zealand vernacular red that I thought was... classically, where we were living at the time, near where you are, in Kilmore Street, there was a fence right by our flat and studio that was kind of that oxide New Zealand red. And it had the marginality of like when the corrugated iron gets taken off and repurposed. So you have these divisions. And that was made, that was a painting that was made in 2005 called Who's Afraid of Walking Frida? And it was a necessary distraction. It was So the fire was the main panel, and they were a series of implant paintings. So in a sense, I saw this site as structurally equivalent to a walk-by painting, but it's already there, it's in sight, it's in situ. So on a smaller scale, they're like bridge paintings where they're multi-panel pieces put together. And I haven't made that many large ones, but when we came here, I was like, well, there's one already here. And it has. And also, I really like the gaps in the glazing to the metal. Yeah. So when that's painted out, all you get is these flickers of
people moving past,
which is, and also to have a double-sided painting, it has all these kind of tropey things to do with painting, like the window, the mirror, and it's a reversed, so all the process is reversed and projected, which is simple but kind of hard to get my head around as well. So it's, that was interesting to have a double-sided painting. It's something that reads.
And there's a Newman reference as well, right? The original 2005 reference.
Yeah, the original work was Who's Afraid of Red, Yellow, Blue. Was referencing that, but it was the kind of New Zealand version of those colours. Mm-hmm. So it was the oxide red and the mustardy yellow, which is the hacienda, and then you start thinking about resin. You think, is resin making our experience, our colour experience, or are they, which way round is it? Because when I made that paint, my brother's 10 years older than me, and he was like, "Wow, so nostalgic, those colours." It's like growing up.
Mm.
So, and I don't know when resin started or, like, was there...
Yeah, I don't know.
I mean, obviously, wall sheds were painted oxide red before resin, but I don't know why really, or how that's come to be.
No, I oscillate between Dulux and resin because they release their magazines at different times of the year, so...
The show is sponsored by Resin, though. This is an exclusively Resin show.
I've got a friendship with Resin, which is perfect.
I don't want to lose that pain, mate.
You are listening to Art Not Science, presented by the Physics Room Contemporary Art Space.
Are there any questions for Ollie or Megan?
Both of the way you've described the works, a lot of it has been about changing how people like deal with the space. But it's like forcing people to do something or like suggesting that they do something else. And quite often to do it like their time study. So it's like extending the journey or like confusing them in terms of this wall, like do I go through it? Like just as it is, like people don't know whether they're allowed to open those doors.
Mm.
Even when they're made of glass and put big candles on the wall, so like confusing people or like just making them spend longer in the space seems to be like a bit of a unifying goal of some kind. But was there like an intention to have to like encourage people to have a different quality of experience? So that it's not just a longer experience, but a different quality of being in this place, or like like the quality of experience. Is that part of the intention?
So one of my influential details is a notebook that I've put up on the bookcase wall, and that seemed like like what you're saying, it's one thing to get people to either trick them or encourage them to stay in a space longer, but to hopefully lead them to this incredible resource, which is this wall of publications, was the intention behind putting an influential notebook up there. Over the time that my dad came down with me, and over the time we've been here installing the space, it's been great just to be able to flick through that, also because the Wi-Fi is a bit crap here. So, it's been amazing, and I've found actually this incredible publication. It's from the Blue Oyster in 2007, and that's going to inform a project that I'm thinking about now. So, and I wouldn't have found that without being able to spend the time with that bookcase. So that was one thing that I really wanted to, aim to achieve. If one person sits down at that table, that would be really awesome.
But I think institutionally it feels completely different. Like the experience that I've been having in it since those windows have been painted out, particularly, and I think the experience that people who are invigilating the space and volunteers who will be in the space is that you do feel a lot more secluded now, and you feel maybe safer. In a less viewed or surveilled way, I think. So I think it will change the experience of potentially the people who spend the most time in the space, which are the people who work here.
Did you have any thinking once the path and the windows were in, with the individual desk being there and the library being here, were there any thoughts of should the invigilator be in a different place, or should they be roaming?
I had this thought. I was just like, maybe we should pull the desk from the. We should just pull invigilators from the show, and lock the storeroom, and really make it literally a thoroughfare and another thoroughfare, and not have anyone here. And I know, it was a brief thing that I thought about maybe in the shower in the morning, and then dismissed it. But that's maybe we'll do it. Maybe we'll try a day of that.
It evokes that kind of, it's contemplative suddenly, isn't it? It's like feels a very different space. I mean, you've created a very different experience for people here, which I think just as a first show of this year, it's really great.
I mean, comfort, I think we probably take for granted how comfortable we feel in contemporary art spaces because are our space, but I know lots of people who find them very confronting and unintentionally excluding. If some wafty music or some nice colours can help to soften an experience or make it more welcoming or make it more encouraging to engage in, that would be great.
The library is interesting because when I was painting the piece, it was I'm in here a lot, but I don't use the library that much, but in between coats I was reading a book, finding things. There's lots of good stuff in there, and it's a historical document of not just this space but artist run spaces around New Zealand. That's really interesting, and these places have to do things to, I think that piece of text I sent you, it's like how do these places survive, and this is a totally different model because it's post-quake, and so there's lots of different kind of nuance that goes into why we're here, how long we're here.
How long did you have to work on the painting?
I think it was a week, because it's five coats, five or some are five, some are six, and then painting around the edges or something like that. Yeah.
Is it particular glass?
No, it's not. I feel like a resin salesman.
Do it.
It's a waterborne enamel that you don't need those fumes in your life. It comes off plastic.
Yeah.
The little tester I did comes off in huge strips of it. So yeah.
But that's the other thing, I guess, in terms of permanence of there will be lingering remnants from both Megan and, less remnant, more the whole thing is probably going to stay. We're going to keep it as a semi-permanent mural for as long as it doesn't totally mess with whatever artist is in the space. But Megan's done, we've changed the vinyl on the door to as close to influential yellow as possible as one of the contemplative points as you're pointing and walking out that way and coming up. And there's also a yellow line in the loading zone that is now influential yellow rather than
Council Street yellow.
Yeah.
No, I did it late last night. When all the council, when they all went home. Because I was kind of just over the last week, but then looking at the windows and counting how many desks are there and who's in charge of the loading zone paint strips and who's going to care. And there's already been a car drive over it, so there's some nice tread gone over, which is cool. And, I mean, it's minuscule. No one...
It's very subtle.
Someone might notice, and that would be great if they did.
Why is this a temporary space? Are you waiting for another space?
Good question. Yes and no. We're kind of waiting to see about Christchurch in a way. And the shift came about, it had been on board agendas since 2010, so pre-quake. But post-quake, we kind of doubled down and took double the space and had two floors, and then there were unforeseen rent increases. It's always been, it's a great space, but it's always been very invisible and very inaccessible. So like that combined with extreme cost, like it was going to be over $100,000 in rent if we had stayed there last year. So I thought it'd be obscene to spend that money on that, on rent, rather than projects or other things that, you know, because we don't get that much money anyway. So that's kind of like, in real terms, like that's nearly a third of the budget would be going into building. And this is $30,000 a year. So it's a lot cheaper. It's a lot more visible. It has strange things in it. It's like, it is a strange space. It is a strange, good thing space. Like, I have to like acknowledge that.
I was thinking driving here though, like how many artists see it as a positive? Because because of visibility, but also being next to the institution.
Yeah.
Well, just, I mean, we have more visits from other institutional staff than we did then.
Because the old openings wouldn't get too many people from CAG coming.
Mm-hmm. But yeah, so there is, and like the survey we've just done, the audience survey, is really interesting. Like we've had some really interesting interactions around size of space, what people would like us to do. Mm-hmm. So we're just kind of going through those things now. And there's there's a CNZ funding all the investment clients, of which the physics room is one of those investment clients. There are two tiers. That is totally up for renegotiation in May this year. So that's another thing about keeping this as a temporary space, that the organization is thinking about what is needed and required and what it wants to do locally and nationally. So our thinking, it's good to stay agile to an extent. So that's your question, Ed, about temporary space.
I'm just thinking about your show. Was it apparent when you came to the install, like, could you see where?
Yeah, there was, but it was hard to tell visually. But so Lauren, who curated that show, after every day would clean it, because it was made out of it was a tufted carpet, a big carpet made of wool, but it was still in its really fluffy stage. So when people would move through it, you could tell, you know, over the weekend there were a lot more people than a Monday, because the amount of fluff that kind of just collected on the surface. And she'd go around every day and collect it and had a little vacuum, and the most fluff would occur in that straight line from entrance to exit. So that was the only real teller. But I mean, it was only in for 3 months as well, and if it was there for longer, I'm sure a more obvious kind of path would fade. But yeah, I mean, the carpet in Dad's house he's had for 20 years and there's no obvious movement, so it needs to be in there for a real long time, I think. Yeah, but I had anticipated that, because it was also it was quite long, the carpet tufts. It wasn't nice short. It was a bit, a little bit shaggy, so I kind of thought it would flop a bit, but yeah, it was more the fluff that gave it away.
All right. Do you want to add anything? would you like to add? Is there anything that you want to grab? Great. Well, these guys will stick around for another 5-10 minutes for conversation if you want to. So thanks so much for coming, and thank you, Ollie. Thanks, Megan.
Thanks, Jeff.
Great work. Cool. Cheers.
Thank you for listening to episode 8 of Art Not Science. Tune in next month on Friday 20th of March for our next episode. Ma te wa!
The Physics Room is generously supported by Creative New Zealand, the Christchurch City Council, the Rata Foundation, Three Boys Brewery, Scientech, Resine Paints, and the Crater Rim.